from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. A new study explores attitudes about race, crime, and punishment, and the chancellor of the California State University system steps down. Those are the stories we'll take up in our next hour of Forum. First up, we'll hear about a Stanford University study that demonstrates how support for tough juvenile justice measures depends in part on whether or not we think the offender is black or white. And then in our second half hour, California State University Chancellor Charles Reed joins us. He announced his retirement yesterday after leading the CSU system for the past 14 years. It's all ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When juveniles commit serious crimes, how severe should the punishment be? That's a question currently before the United States Supreme Court, and it's also the question Stanford University researchers decided to explore in a new study, but with a twist. The researchers wanted to find out if our attitudes towards juvenile crime and the punishment those offenders should receive depend in part on whether or not we think the offender is white or black. A nationally representative sample of white Americans were asked to consider a case based on a prior Supreme Court decision. A 14-year-old with 17 prior juvenile convictions is found to have brutally raped an elderly woman. In such a case, is a life sentence without parole appropriate? And now here's the twist. Half of the survey participants were told the juvenile offender was white, the other half black. What they found out in that study and the broader issue of juvenile crime and juvenile punishment is what we're going to explore in this first half hour of Forum. Joining us is Anitha Ratan. She is a postdoctoral research scholar in the psychology department at Stanford University. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you here as well. And James Bell joins us as well. He is founder and executive director of the W. Hayward Burns Institute. Their mission is to protect and improve the lives of youth of color. Mr. Bell, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with what you found out, Anitha Ratan, in this study. You asked people this question, is life without parole appropriate in this kind of horrific crime? But half were told the offender was white, half were told the offender was black. What did you find out?
Thanks for asking that. So one of the really interesting things about this type of case is that the issue of protection is pitted against the issue of punishment. So there are well-established protections that the Supreme Court has upheld time and again, preventing juveniles from receiving the same severity of punishment as adults.
For example, just a half a dozen years ago, sure, they ruled that there could not be capital punishment for juveniles.
Exactly. And that's one of the big cases that really helped reify this precedent. And so in these types of cases where there is a severe offense and yet it's been committed by someone who is a juvenile and who the courts determine deserve protections above and beyond what those we would otherwise give to adults, we were interested in seeing whether race could affect people's attitudes towards those protections and then towards the punishments that would stem from those protections. So we told people about just one example case. We said, you know, the Supreme Court is weighing whether or not these protections should apply to life in prison without the possibility of parole for non-homicide cases. We told them some statistics about these types of cases, and we told them you're just going to read about one example offender. So they didn't even think they were judging this specific target. Instead, we said, we're really interested in your opinions about these types of penalties and this precedent, whether juveniles should be seen as different from adults. And what we found was that when participants had just read the one word black instead of the one word white embedded in a larger body of text, they were both more supportive of life in prison without the possibility of parole for all juveniles. And although everyone thought juveniles were different from adults, the degree to which they thought that shifted based on the race of this example offender they had read about.
So they were less forgiving or less willing to say juveniles ought to get a break if they thought that juvenile was black.
So it's not that they thought a specific juvenile who they were judging was black. But yeah, if they had just read about one example case with a black offender.
And how significant were the differences in the study? When told that the offender in this case was white versus the offender was black, how significant were the differences that you found?
That's a great question. So they were significant statistically in terms of how we analyzed the data. What's really interesting about this research is that we only changed one word and we still produced a significant effect. And I think that's really important to acknowledge and really compelling that just this one single word change could produce any kind of an effect that would be significant. Even if, you know, when we talk about statistically the effect sizes and things, it's a modest effect. And I want to acknowledge that. It's just important to consider the fact that in the real world, you don't just encounter one word to cue someone's race. You encounter many words, other associations that have to do with that word, and the person themselves.
So it was a significant effect determined and provoked by just being primed with a word, not
yes.
a series of images.
Nope.
This is not like the Willie Horton effect where
no.
you have a picture.
We really went with the most minimal thing we could think to do to see if it would produce any effect, and it did.
Anitha Ratan, she's a postdoctoral research scholar at Stanford University. James Bell joins us as well. Mr. Bell, you've spent your professional life working on these issues, and your institute, the W. Hayward Burns Institute, is all about trying to protect and improve the lives of youths of color. When you hear about this study at Stanford that just came out this week, I'm just very curious at first to just learn your immediate response to it.
Is that I am not surprised, and it's this kind of research that is much needed to move anecdote into a more evidence-based findings about what we encounter when we're in jurisdictions around the country. We're in about 32 jurisdictions around the country, and what we find is that for similar treatment, kids of color are more brought into the youth justice system, more brought into incarceration. And what I believe is the driver for this is a notion that I think this research begins to uncover about appropriateness. Somewhere in our society, there's a belief that justice systems, incarceration, and the things that are attendant thereto are more appropriate for kids of color that are particularly in neighborhoods of concentrated poverty. And so I think that this kind of research bears out what we're seeing. And I'll put it in this phrase, and that is that we find that courts, probation departments, and child-serving systems would much rather incarcerate young people of color that are not really in danger of committing crimes against public safety, but have much higher social needs in terms of counseling or the effects of trauma. And so there's a bargain that has been struck that this research gets to, and that is that it's okay to incarcerate kids of color in order to get them basic services, because the notion is that incarceration is pretty benign, and they get a better impact because they have high needs, and hey, while you're locked up, you can see a counselor, or hey, while you're locked up, you can go to school, or hey, while you're locked up, you can get a better meal than you would normally get. And so I think that this surfaces that kind of sense that the justice system or harsher punishment is appropriate for young people of color and inappropriate for white kids.
James Bell, founder and executive director of the W. Hayward Burns Institute. And just to go over some of the statistics, as I understand them at least, youth of color represent something like 70% of those who are confined in juvenile facilities, while they are only 38% of the population. So overrepresented by a factor of two. And you see these in the statistics throughout this topic. And one thing else I wanted to add about the study that I find fascinating, Anitha Ratan, is that you tried to screen out in terms of the people who were surveyed. This is 700 and some people, nationally representative sample, people who confessed a certain prejudice. So you're surveying people who believe that they don't have any prejudice. Is that correct?
So it's a little different from that, actually. So we surveyed everyone, regardless of their prejudice. And then what you're talking about is what we did to control for prejudice. So we had everyone survey responses. And then we looked at whether our effects, these differences in people's perceptions of punishment and of this policy, whether those effects would be the case for people who were both high in prejudice and people who were low in prejudice. And what we found was that regardless of how much explicit prejudice people confessed to, whether they felt more warm or less warm to African Americans, these effects held.
We want to open up our phone lines, too, to hear your thoughts about this study. What do you make of these results that people came up with very different attitudes about the severity of what was appropriate in terms of juvenile punishment based on whether or not they just heard one word, and that one word was black? What do you think of those results? Have you ever experienced something like this yourself, where you feel like people's attitudes towards you have been profoundly affected by the perception of race? Or on the other side, do you feel like you've made those judgments about someone else based on whether or not you have certain assumptions about what race they are? Have you ever opened the door and found someone on the other side who was black and reacted one way versus white? I'd like to hear your thoughts on this topic and the way in which you think perception affects your views on race and on juvenile crime. 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. James Bell, how are you dealing with these perception issues within the work that you're doing? In other words, when you're working with kids in certain situations, how are you dealing with both those kids and the people they work with to overcome these sort of built-in perceptions that we seem to have?
Thank you for that. Our work focuses on the adults that have to make decisions about young people. We know that adolescents and teenagers are risk takers. They make poor decisions sometimes. And most children across race and ethnicity participate in the same kinds of activities. The question is, once you are in trouble with the law, how do adults respond? And so what we do is take a data-driven approach to look at how adults are making decisions that actually may disparately impact different communities. And so that's our approach, is to not tell stories, to not be involved in anecdote, but to look at data to say, what are these kids' behaviors? How are we responding to them? And is that response fair and equitable?
And how often in your work with kids do you come across this particular problem, that part of why the kids you're working with are in a juvenile facility is really tied to the function of how they've been perceived, what the race and that they are a part of, and the way in which people judge because of that race?
Absolutely, and I guess I did an inarticulate job of trying to explain that before. It's a notion of appropriateness. It is definitely alive in that if a system thinks that it's appropriate for you or you are appropriate for it, it's going to bring you into it, and for kids of color, bring them deeper into it. If the system believes that you are inappropriate for it, it will try to expel you. And what I've tried to say is that kids of color from neighborhoods of concentrated poverty in our city, that would be the Tenderloin, that would be Bayview Hunters Point, Visitation Valley, there's this sense that because of where you live and your race ethnicity, the system is appropriate for you. Whereas if you live in Pacific Heights or you're from another neighborhood of more means, they'll say, oh, no, you shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
And race and ethnicity is definitely, as this study has shown, very potent in that decision making.
Let's hear what some of our listeners have to say about this question. Phone lines are already full. Let's hear first from Cleveland, who joins us in Palo Alto. Cleveland, go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead. Mark. You're on the air.
Yeah, I do agree with that. Race is a really intimate inside of the decisions that are made against people. I live in the city of Palo Alto, where I've had a complaint of my city telling me they were the Ku Klux Klan and trying to plant crack on me, and I've gone to my city council hundreds of times, and they've just all but ignored me because I'm black and poor. Well, once there was a white lady who said she was groped by a police officer, and she had the voice of a mouse. You barely even heard her, but she was put into the newspaper, and the city settled out with her for a tremendous amount of money. And so I know if you're a black person and you live in America, that race does exist. And their decisions. It's you can. It's just sort of like if you sell crack cocaine, you get a certain amount of time. Well, crack is made from cocaine.
Cleveland, let me hold you. Let me hold you there and let James Bell respond, because the drug question is of something that comes up a lot. Because statistically, James Bell, there are more actually white kids who are involved with drugs than black, and yet disproportionately, what happens in terms of the system is that more black kids wind up being incarcerated for that. Is that correct?
Absolutely, and you've said it. When self-reporting, white kids self-report more drug use than kids of color. But I'll give you another example that I think I'll do quickly, because I know you have callers, is that when you talk to white kids about curfew, and you talk to black kids and Latino kids, Asian kids about curfew, you will often hear white kids say, oh, we don't worry about curfew because we know those laws really don't apply to us.
Mm-hmm.
As you talk to black kids and Latino kids, and they know that it's very potent. So it is that kind of thing. But what we don't want to do is point fingers. What we want to do is look at data, look at how the system is receiving and implementing these practices to make sure they're as fair and equitable as possible.
A couple of people calling in, and let's hear from Waits next in Santa Rosa on this topic, or rather, sorry, we're going to go to Frank first in Menlo Park, and then a couple of people are calling in, and I want you to respond to this, Anitha, about how significant these results are. People want to know the number, and so we'll get to that in a moment. But Frank, we've got you up next, so go ahead, please.
Yes, hi, good morning. In response to the gentleman who's speaking there, the juvenile justice system is supposed to be more focused on rehabilitation than punishment, like the adult system is. And he's saying that his work, his studies, show that very often the courts, the probation officers, even the police, are more inclined to take a kid into the juvenile justice system and maybe including some incarceration if the kids come from, I think the term he used was neighborhoods of concentrated poverty. And it certainly sounds to me like the decisions that are being made by judges and probation officers and even police officers are based perhaps more on class differences, mm-hmm. socioeconomic differences, at least as much as race. Of course, unfortunately, we all know that unfortunately in these poor areas, of especially black families, the family structures are not very strong, and I'm sure that contributes to the chances of kids getting into trouble. But it does sound more based on socioeconomic differences as race differences.
Frank, thanks.
Thank
James Bell?
Absolutely. That is a criteria that you use. And oftentimes, though, zip codes are a proxy for socioeconomic and also a proxy for race. And so we know that if we're talking about socioeconomic differences, it still falls harder on people of color if you were to look at that research.
A couple of people have wanted to call in, and Peter also writes in on this question, Anitha Ratan. I don't want to question your guest results, but mm-hmm. they've not yet answered how significant the findings were. They answered that they were statistically significant, but statistically significant does not in itself imply large. So how large is the fact? How precise can you be about what you actually found?
I really appreciate the opportunity to speak about that and to clarify. So when we say they're statistically significant, what that means is that there is a meaningful difference between the way participants who just saw that one word black versus that one word white are viewing punishment and this precedent that juveniles should be considered less than adults.
Can you put it, though, in percentage terms? In other words, did 80% of the people who were told that the offender was black think yes, life imprisonment is fine, versus only 20% if they thought the offender was white?
So I can't exactly put it in those types of terms, because in our types of research, we don't ask people yes or no questions. We ask them to respond how much. So on a 1 to 7 scale, let's say, how much this would be different. What I can say, though, is that these effects are statistically significant above and beyond the effects of explicit racial prejudice. So if we control for prejudice, they remain significant. We know from other research out there that political ideology is associated with punitiveness. So people who are more conservative tend to support punitive measures. Even if we take out that part of people's perceptions. Even if we control for conservativeness, again, these effects are statistically significant. So they're, what we found in this one study is that they were very reliable. When we talk about significance in the broader context of society, that's where, you know, we have to ask, well, what do we make of this? How do we make meaning out of these types of results? And that's where, you know, individuals can differ on what they think in terms of how punitive we ought to be. However, in the justice system, we know that we ought to be equally punitive for people who've committed the same crime. And that's where we think these results have meaning.
Why not survey? I mentioned in the introduction that this was a survey of white Americans. Why not survey black respondents as well? Why not see whether or not you saw these same different racial perceptions among black or Latino Americans, Native Americans, whoever?
Absolutely. I would love to do that. It is one of the things we really want to do in future research. And because we found that these effects persist above and beyond explicit racial prejudice, we actually might expect that it's possible for black respondents or Asian respondents or Latino respondents to show the same effects. The reason that as a starting point, we began working, surveying white participants is because whites are statistically overrepresented in the judiciary, in the legislative system, and on juries. And so in some sense, as a starting point, these are the people who might be making these decisions, so we wanted to see what they thought.
Let's take one more call. Alex in Oakland is next. Alex, go ahead, please.
Hi. Yeah, so just quickly, one thought that your research sort of brought to my mind is that a possibility is that maybe people's attitudes towards crime and punishment might be driven, at least in part, by their belief that there are more black criminals, basically. And I'm wondering if you can comment on that and if you have any more specific research on that topic.
Okay, Alex, thanks for the question. James, why don't you go to that first, even though I know this is not your study, but do you think that perception is affected by just a global fear that there is more black crime? James Bell?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was for my colleague. Yes, that is the perception. One of the things that we do when we work in jurisdictions is do an anonymous survey to see why people think that kids of color are overrepresented in their systems. And oftentimes what they'll say is serious violent offenses, much more serious crimes. And when we actually look at the data of what's going on there, the reason for overrepresentation cannot be justified by crime alone. And so there are other reasons that this kind of research gets at that reflects that.
We have to leave off, unfortunately, in just a moment, but a quick last thought from you, James Bell, and then to Anitha Rathan on where you think this study points us in terms of what we really need to find out or what we need to explore, I guess, about ourselves in terms of the way in which our racial attitudes affect our view of crime and punishment.
The study is a step on the way, and I would encourage also more research, as she said, with other ethnicities, towards the notion that justice should be administered fairly and equitably, even understanding that we're humans and we have human flaws, but we should do everything that we can to make sure that those perceptions are not determinative of justice.
And Anitha Rathan, the last thought from you is the concern, really, that this undermines our basic principle that juveniles somehow ought to be treated differently.
Yes, it undermines that. And further, it undermines our basic goal in the U.S. in our justice system of having equal protection under the law. You know, in the Supreme Court case that raised some of these issues in 2010 and in the Supreme Court case that the justices will be determining an outcome for any day now, neither of these cases really mentioned the role of race as a potential factor in who's getting these protections. And what we really hope to do is to raise a discourse and start a conversation.
And we'll hope to continue that conversation further at a later date. Anitha Rathan, James Bell, thanks both very much for your contributions to our conversation. No doubt we'll return to this topic again in the future. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.